Hello, my friends. My goodness, can you believe how steadily we are moving to the end of the year? It's that time of year where we can feel pulled by the forces of family, season, and consumerism. I want you to remember to come back to you. Check in with yourself throughout the season with a pause, a breath, a word of self-compassion, a word of kindness. And there are a couple of special things I have planned to support you. First of all, for all my yoga teachers out there, I am leading a trauma-informed yoga teacher training this January 24th and 25th. It is so easy to traumatize or re-traumatize a practitioner in yoga spaces. In this training, you'll discover what it means to recognize and support trauma survivors in yoga studios and to bring yoga teaching off the mat. The info is on my website, laraland.us, under consulting, and of course, we'll have it in the show notes. And second, but certainly not least, I am doing very, very special episode on this podcast on December 22nd. I will be leading an alignment and manifestation workshop based on my life purpose journal and year-long coaching program, My Bliss Book. So purchase your copy of My Bliss Book in advance so you can do all the meditations and visualizations along with me, get past your blocks, out of your way, and start manifesting the life of your dreams in 2026. And that is also linked in the show notes and available on my website. I am so excited to bring this offering to you and to see what you cook up for the new year. I'm Lara Land, somatic coach and yoga teacher trainer, and this is the Beyond Trauma podcast. What a couple of years we have had. The challenges continue to grow, and more of us are experiencing some level of traumatic stress. My commitment here is to bring you the most up-to-date insights on exactly how trauma affects our mind-body-spirit system and how we can work with our bodies to soften its impacts. You will be hearing from trauma survivors and researchers, and together, we are going to incorporate what they have to teach us to heal ourselves and promote the well-being of all those around us. Here we go. Beyond Trauma listeners, did you know you can always start over? Giving myself permission to begin again at any moment has allowed me to constantly evolve, and it's a tool I use with all of my coaching clients. It's also the premise of my first book, My Bliss Book. My Bliss Book is an undated life purpose planner that comes with an automated coaching program sent directly to your inbox biweekly when you enroll using the secret URL found inside the book. You will receive my creative visualization meditation, encouraging you to move beyond social programming and self-imposed limitations and into visualizing your truest, most honest vision for your own unique life. Then using my Bliss Book, you will work backwards to develop actionable steps to meet goals throughout the year that take you towards your big vision. Have a habit of buying pretty planners and putting them down before they're finished? Not a problem. My bi-weekly emails provide just the nudge needed to pick up your planner again. And if you miss a few days, you don't waste your book. The book is undated, so you can always start again. My Bliss Book is available off my site, laraland.us, and is now 20% off for my podcast listeners with code STARTAGAIN. But hurry, this discount won't run forever. Okay, everyone, welcome back. We're getting into it today, some details on what you want to think about and work on if there's been trauma response, especially complex trauma. Really getting into the nitty-gritty of exposure and when and how and creating safety and grounding exercises. Lots of good stuff here. I'm also talking about group therapy, what that looks like when you're working with a group, and also cultural considerations, especially for immigrants. It's a really rich and technical episode with a lot of takeaways, both for regular folks, quote unquote regular folks, and for clinicians. So very excited. I have on today Dr. Mercedes Okosi, who's a bilingual New York State licensed clinical psychologist practicing in New York City and specializing in trauma. She studied applied psychology at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. This was a developmental and sociocultural focused program that immersed her in foundational psychology knowledge and fieldwork opportunities to work with marginalized populations. Her fieldwork, in fact, involved working with adolescents and young adults in a nonprofit setting, dealing with mental illness, poverty, immigration, and many other psychosocial burdens. She advanced immediately into clinical psychology doctoral program at the prestigious Graduate School of Applied and Professional Psychology at Rutgers University, gained 5 years of direct clinical experience, and was able to expand her range of experience across settings. This is a wonderful, wonderful, like I said, very technical interview, and I think you're going to just absolutely love this. Here you go. Dr. Mercedes Arcosi, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I was really excited to connect with you and get to learn about your work. Do you want to tell folks a little bit about your background and the kind of specialties and services that you provide?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Dr. Mercedes Arcosi. I'm a clinical psychologist in New York. I work at a university and then also run a private practice where I practice and supervise some other clinicians. We see a range of people with all kind of different presentations, mostly adults, but kind of across the span of developmental ages. But I specialize in trauma and PTSD, so a lot of people are seeking me out for those services particularly. And I have some training in particular trauma-informed approaches, but also see people for a range of things from life transitions, anxiety, depression, personality disorders, and a bunch of different multiple kind of presentations. So yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to talk about things.
Yeah, so much to go into there. With your trauma work, do you want to share a little bit about what you're finding to be most useful?
Yeah, so I decided to specialize in trauma because across a lot of different presentations I saw, there were, I guess, a couple of things. One, I had met a lot of patients who had seen therapists before, and the therapist would do an intake and screen for the typical anxiety, depression, mood things. But in a lot of cases, and I think it's getting better now with being trauma-informed, I met so many people who had never been asked or never told anyone about their trauma history. And a lot of the times it ended up overlapping with or being a better explanation for how like fear or mood symptoms or avoidance was showing up in their lives. So I think that oftentimes, especially people who are dealing with multiple layers of stigma, have a hard time finding or being feeling safe enough to find the space to talk through really traumatic events that have happened to them. Most trauma treatment is centered around, whether it's verbally or in some other way, processing the trauma memories or the way that the trauma is showing up physically in your body, thoughts, feelings now, so that people develop a sense of safety as they're moving throughout the world with less hesitation. So, yeah.
And are you starting with stabilizing like what's going on immediately and then going into the past? Or what's your like general practice of the way that you're working? Are there certain methods, theories, interventions that you're using?
Yeah. So most of the time, or what I have most experience in, is prolonged exposure therapy or narrative therapy before getting, because you don't want to flood someone and dive deep into like their most terrible life memory. It depends on the person, but generally before that, there is a period of sessions where you assess what coping skills they already have and then reinforce those while providing psychoeducation and building up additional skills. So things like general emotional regulation and distress tolerance, ways that they can practice regulating their nervous system through breathing exercises, general self-care. Sometimes people are in a state where they're not even handling the basics well, like how are you eating, sleeping, and exercising, but also like grounding skills, different types of mindfulness that prepare them to then have tools in response to when you do start doing the deeper work. So a lot of trauma therapy is first developing and reinforcing those skills. And then there's kind of like talking about the trauma. So how are we preparing to talk about this? Sometimes that's talking through how is this impacting you now and how are you coping with the impacts of that now? So somebody might already have insight into, well, because of the things that have happened to me, this is how it's playing out in my relationships now. And sometimes there are immediate things to address there before going back and explicitly processing the memories themselves, or they're dealing with a lot of anxiety around or hypervigilance around particular triggers. So we work on using some of the skills to manage that. Then we eventually get to, let's create a hierarchy of how we're going to approach slowly but surely processing the memories. And then we get into doing the narrative itself, where they talk through the particular moments in more detail and see that they can get through talking about the memories, not necessarily forgetting about the event, but seeing that with those coping skills, it's going to be uncomfortable, but they can reestablish a sense of safety and get back to a sense of balance.
And do you find it's different for someone who's had like a prolonged complex trauma history versus a single event?
Yeah, a lot of the time when someone has like an isolated, like one event trauma, depending on the person and depending on what the event was, it can be as difficult as someone who's had more complex trauma. But sometimes a little bit more or less complicated, because people who have complex trauma, generally that complex trauma was like prolonged and interpersonal in nature. So sometimes they might still be connected to those people or places where they were harmed. Sometimes they might be still in similar circumstances. Like if you think about things like someone living in poverty, someone living with a lot of instability still in their lives, someone still connected somehow to the person or people that abused them multiple times. So that makes it a little bit more complicated, because there may be like the post in terms of like the explicit acute traumatic events of abuse or whatever it may be have stopped, but there are still things that are strongly connecting them to the past, where it's not as easy for it to just be a memory anymore. And with complex trauma, a lot of the time, there are more of the, not just like the classic PTSD symptoms in terms of like hypervigilance and fear, but a little bit more of the mood symptoms and sometimes more dissociative experiences. So it can require a lot more regulation and support in those cases. And some people feel hopeless because they've been going through or went through traumatic events or circumstances for such a long time. But it's hard to imagine, like, what does feeling stable and safe even feel like in their environment, but even sometimes like in their own body in terms of how it's impacted their self-concept. So treatment with those patients can be a little bit more complicated, a little longer sometimes.
Yeah, because I'm wondering that those cases, as you're inviting them to retell a story, there might be multiple stories. And I'm also wondering, you know, do you have them pick the first one, the most salient one? And is it enough to remember and retell the story without getting activated to make that personality change? Because a lot of, you know, what you're talking about, that long time of trauma can often turn into mood dysregulation and even personality and relational diagnoses and issues later. Is the insight enough? Is it a combination of having insight over how those memories are living on later with also the body regulation? What do you think makes the long-lasting change, I guess?
Yeah, I think for those, and you had a great question at the beginning about like, so for example, someone may say that part of their trauma is abuse from a parent. a lot of the time, it's not just like my parent hit me one time, but like a series of events. Maybe for some people, it was happening like monthly, weekly, daily, and different levels of intensity. Or they may say like having a parent that dealt with substance abuse was a traumatic just circumstance and everything that happened then. So in that case, yeah, in terms of like making the list of memories that we'll process, I will ask the person to think of if there was a first time, a last time, or a worst time that feels the most salient. And sometimes they may pick like a couple, or maybe sometimes there's like one thing that stands out. But a lot of the time there's kind of a generalizing effect where the process of doing the trauma narrative is, yes, about the content of the memory, but it's also about the experiential component of seeing that there's this really scary thing that happened, but I'm not there anymore, but it still scares me to even think about the memory. And I'm avoiding that because in the short term, avoidance feels great to not think about that or deal with it, avoid those people, places. In the long term, though, I'm sweeping all of these feelings under the rug and they're unprocessed, so eventually have to confront. So sometimes that generalizing effect of just the experiential component is, let's say maybe I talk about that one worst highlighted incident of the time that my parent abused me. Seeing that I can get through that and that, yes, it'll feel uncomfortable to talk about and I'll feel some feelings reemerge, but I got through it. And with the support of my therapist, I felt safe again at the end. That generalizes sometimes to, if I can do that, and maybe we have to repeat it a couple of sessions, I can be a little bit less scared of all of the other incidents as well. So sometimes we don't have to necessarily go through every single memory of a type of event for someone who's dealt with a lot of complex trauma, but the experiential component of seeing that they can get through it helps them see that, like, okay, there's safety on the other side.
Yeah, I love that. It's a great point about it generalizing. How much detail do you have the person go into, and are they walking through it as if it's present, or are they watching it as an adult with like care for that child? Is it both?
Yeah. So in the approaches that I'm most trained in, you do kind of prompt them to re-experience it as in kind of like an exposure exercise, in the sense that you ask them to tell the narrative in first person present tense as if they're going through it. And with all of the sensory information they can recall, so sight, smell, touch, taste, etc. So that would sound like, instead of saying, yesterday I ate a bagel for breakfast, it would be, I'm waking up. I see the sun shining outside of my window. I feel the hunger in my stomach. I start to walk upstairs and get the bagel, and like in that sense. And the purpose of that is that, again, a lot of what kind of perpetuates the other trauma symptoms is the avoidance, which is a symptom itself. And so you're really like helping guide them through, or supporting while they guide themselves through, kind of like the total opposite of avoidance, which is like complete exposure. Of course, there are other trauma-informed methods that I'm less of an expert in, but where sometimes you don't talk about the trauma narrative at all, and you just do like a somatic experiencing thing. I know some people do EMDR without necessarily talking about the events, and just process in other ways. In cognitive processing therapy, you're talking about the event, but more about like the thoughts and stuck points. So yeah, it depends.
Yeah, it seems like the umbrella though is what you said, which is so important, which is the avoidance is one of the symptoms, and then the perpetuation of the avoidance is unfortunately what makes everything else worse. And then I see that across so many diagnoses, where people's tolerance for discomfort just becomes smaller and smaller through avoidance. I'm wondering what some of your favorite, maybe you could tell us one or two favorite grounding exercises are. What do you find most effective for helping people to breathe through or ground through discomfort?
Yeah. So two things come to mind. An easy one to go to and for most people to remember is like the 5-4-3-2-1 method you may have heard of. And that uses all of your senses and kind of like asks you to ground yourself in the present. So you're finding 5 things you can see, 4 things you can hear, 3 things you can touch, and 1 or 2 things you can taste or smell. So some people will like, it makes you have to look around and realize like, I am in this environment right now, feeling present in my body using my senses. Another thing that's been helpful for people is having like some like physical object ground them. I've been in sessions sometime where, especially if a person is talking about like really deep childhood trauma and kind of like having a regressive moment of feeling back in their childhood and kind of dissociated, to like have like something to hold on to. I remember working with one woman who was in her like late 40s and was talking about something from like early childhood and like held on to a stuffed animal kind of as like a transfer of energy, but just to like be in the present holding something. So yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. And I wonder what you think of this. When I'm teaching people grounding exercises, I'm often encouraging them to practice when they're feeling well. So not to just wait till you're dysregulated, but more like get in the habit, because when we're dysregulated is when we're most likely to not remember what to do. But if we've already made it a habit when we're not so dysregulated, it can come to us more quickly.
Yeah, exactly. I think with any skill, like when I'm talking to people about their routines and self-care or sleep hygiene or mindfulness, meditation kind of things, like this is not for just like when you're in the panic mode and need to find something to regulate, but like things that are going to keep your baseline at a more calm point so that you're less likely to become so dysregulated in an intense way in the first place. And that if you do experience some distress, you know already the things that get you back to that calm baseline. So yeah, definitely.
Such a good point, right? If you're already started agitated, it's gonna, you know, you're already starting from up here, then of course you're closer to being really, really dysregulated. Whereas if you're just constantly managing your stress level and really that self-care, so much can be done by that baseline of good sleep. It's often the things that I don't know why people don't want to hear, but we have to just talk about the basics first.
Yeah. I think people want like immediate relief of their distress and kind of see those self-care things, especially with like all of the pressure of the things we have to do in terms of working and living. Like some people see sleep as a luxury, unfortunately, that like getting enough hours of sleep and having a good routine is like something you do because you're lucky to do so, but not, and something that we can take for granted, but is like an essential thing to health, physical and mental health, you know?
Yeah. We just did a series on sleep and talked about, you know, how much just one night of really lack of sleep can make us more emotional and irritable the next day. And I certainly see that in my own personality. The people close to me can definitely tell if I haven't had a good night's sleep. I know I wanted to talk a little bit about group work, because it's something we haven't discussed on the podcast. And I think people have an idea of therapy that it always looks a certain way, and maybe don't know so much about the power of groups. I'm wondering what kind of groups you've run or clinicians run in your practice, and some of the special things that can be done and happen in group that aren't always happening in the one-to-one.
Yeah. So most recently, for the past few years in private practice, I've been doing a women of color trauma group. So any woman that identifies as a woman of color who's experienced trauma has joined. In the past, I've done a mixture of different groups for different populations in different settings. some groups for substance use, some for psychosis, some for like just interpersonal skills groups, parenting groups. So groups can vary, but the idea is that there's sometimes like a common presenting problem or a common population, or sometimes it can be a mixture of things, but like people wanting to have an interpersonal experience. I think sometimes people are hesitant about groups because they feel like, well, I'm getting less attention or less treatment if I'm in a group and not one-on-one. But it's kind of like a totally different intervention based depending on what kind of group it is. You can have a more psychoeducational group where you're like learning skills and trying things and it's a little more structured. Or you can have a completely open process group where a therapist is there for reflection and guidance, but you're kind of just like letting the group unfold and interact, or a mixture of things. The Women of Color Trauma group that I did was kind of a mixture of psychoeducation and process. But the things that you get from a group that you don't get individually and that I found people benefit from are a couple things. So I think the biggest thing is the like universality. So a lot of the time people can think I'm the only one going through this and no one understands me. And it's interesting to see in groups when people get to that point of vulnerability to share more and will say like, wow, I didn't think anybody else felt this way. But seeing that like another person similar to you has similar experiences or has an understanding through their lived experience helps you to not feel alone. In groups, you also develop a different understanding of yourself. In one-on-one therapy, generally your therapist is not going to be very self-disclosing. You're not going to have the same type of interaction. In a group with other group members, they're going to be self-disclosing more. They may give you feedback on how you're being received. So then you're understanding how you're perceived by others or your behaviors and things like that. And that can translate a little more easily to like your generalized experiences outside in the world with other people. So you're kind of doing that like interpersonal learning of both how you're perceived, how you perceive other people, feedback, giving feedback. You may learn a lot of information from other group members. Like sometimes in the Women of Color Trauma group, people would share like different specific coping things that helped for them. And that would be things other people were inspired to try. A lot of the time, people who maybe are more shy or reserved can have a safe space to like practice socialization. It can be a good experience for people who felt like they've had very unhealthy attachments or disconnected or have had conflicts in family or friendship, can have a healthy facilitated experience of connecting with other people. So there's a lot of benefits to groups. And then in a successful group too, people become inspired by seeing the growth of the other people in the group. So for example, in the Women of Color Trauma group, we did some psychoeducation. We like people processed, people provided support to each other. And we did a little bit of the like narrative. So people would say and talk through some of their memories. And it was helpful even for the other people who hadn't gone and told a story or a narrative yet to see like, okay, another person did this and got through it. And I felt all of these feelings of empathy or sympathy for and compassion toward them. They seem like they're like receiving that and growing from that. And then when it's my turn, I can receive that too. So group can be very beneficial. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of benefits you listed right there. I'm curious, what are some of the techniques or strategies that you use to help create a space where people start to feel safe enough to disclose to other people, especially some of those people who are more shy?
Yeah, I think at the beginning of any group, regardless of the style or population, is starting out setting up norms or guidelines and really like eliciting that information from the group itself. So at the beginning of any group, I'll ask people like, what's going to help people feel safe in this group? Like, I will say the general things about, like, confidentiality, et cetera, et cetera. But then other people may have specific things that they can voice that are going to help them to feel more comfortable. And for the first few sessions and then throughout, like, reinforcing those things. Sometimes, if it feels appropriate, I will, to facilitate things, like, just notice that the person who's a little bit more quiet hasn't said much and invite them to talk or invite them to reflect or just like make observations on people's behavior.
And so sometimes part of the process in groups is kind of allowing a little bit of conflict to arise in the different personalities. Can you speak a little to that and how you manage that?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I have an example. Thankfully, in the groups that I've been doing most recently, there haven't been any major conflicts, but there are definitely in groups of the past have been. I think you let it unfold because the conflict itself means something, like the people who are involved, how the other people not involved are observing or being bystanders or interfering or not matters. And so you're observing that and kind of formulating both, like, why is this happening between these two group members? Is this coming from something that's been developing for a while, or is it just out of nowhere? How are the other group members responding? Of course, if it gets to a point where it's like completely not productive, or if it, of course, gets like heated or physical or anything like that, it, you know, at some point needs to stop. But I think it's also that like experiential benefit of having an experience where it's okay for people to disagree or have conflict and facilitate that, like, the people involved can both be heard and still honor the guidelines of the group and respect each other, at least at a basic level. I think a lot of people in groups can end up like reenacting things or styles of conflict resolution or lack of resolution that they had in their families. And so it may be that someone is like acting out and they're used to other people escalating with them and it ends in like chaos. So in a group, to kind of let it like healthily unfold, as long as no one's like being verbally abused or hurt too much, and kind of like containing it. And seeing that, like, we can come out on the other side of this. And maybe you two don't like each other. And maybe you'll never agree. But we can come back to respecting the guidelines of the group so that it's a space where everyone can be heard.
Yes. And I these are some of the reasons that I think groups are so powerful. Because, of course, there's a lot you can't really see in the one-on-one. Now, sometimes your clients will act out in ways that they act out within other relationships. And there's a way of like noticing that how they are with you in a one-on-one is probably how they are in some other relationships. But also, you know, a lot of times they'll try to be on their best behavior or please you, or they want you to like them. And so there's more opportunity in the groups to see kind of what can come up. And what a great modeling to show people another way of working through conflicts. You know, maybe some of us are conflict avoidant, or, you know, conflicts always end in a certain way, but here we come back, there's the container, they know you're there. And so we can really learn another way to work through.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, just going back to that earlier question, what are some of the interesting, or if any come to mind, can things that come up when you ask people what they need to feel safe, any cool suggestions that have been added into the group container?
Yeah. So sometimes there are kind of like basic things like, let's not talk over each other. People talk about like, you know, let's make sure we're mindful of people's pronouns. Like, don't make assumptions or don't give unsolicited advice to other group members who haven't asked for it. Sometimes if people have like particular sensory things, I had someone in a group once ask like to keep outside noise to a minimum. So like any like tapping noises or things like that. Yeah, those have been some of the things.
Yeah. It's interesting how, like, when we talk about trauma-informed yoga and we do sometimes do like group agreements, sometimes you have a conflict where one person is like, to feel safe, I need to be able to move around whenever I need to. And another person's like, to feel safe, I need everything to be still and I need to know where everyone is in the room. And so just navigating different people's needs and what they need to feel safe. And it's so interesting and it can teach us so much about ourselves and how we are with others and what are fixed boundaries versus like where we have some room to maybe open up those boundaries a little bit.
I haven't had any experience yet where someone's like contribution to the guidelines or thing that would help them feel safe was like a direct conflict with someone else's. But it's interesting to think about like what would happen in a situation like that. And I think even then it could be like a conversation with a group of like, how do you imagine we resolve this? Or what can we agree on? You know?
Yeah. Which is so great again for modeling, you know, how you might do that with a partner, you know? And it's just practice. It's life practice. So I just love group work for all those reasons.
Yeah.
And there was another specialty that I wanted to talk to you about when I was learning about you and your work, which is that you work with a lot of Spanish-speaking clients. Is that right?
Yeah. So I, especially as someone who has an immigrant parent, not from a Spanish-speaking place, but that's a whole other story. I'm interested in working with a lot of people who are immigrants or children of immigrants. I happen to just like learn Spanish throughout school for a long time and in life living in different Spanish-speaking areas. So it's been helpful clinically. I was previously working somewhere on a research, clinical research team where we had a lot of Spanish-speaking families. So there were some times where I was doing therapy exclusively in Spanish. So yeah, it's interesting there dealing with immigrant families and from Spanish-speaking countries, but from all kind of different places coming to the U.S. and dealing with like the differences in adapting to a new cultural context, the like multi-generational differences between a parent from another country and their kid growing up here with all of the pressures to preserve family culture, but then have peer influence. It's also where like intergenerational trauma considerations and things come in terms of how things have been transmitted through families over different generations and how people are dealing with that now. So yeah, a lot comes up doing therapy in another language. And also like how people express themselves in their first language versus if English is their second language and what comes up there. Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's so much to say there. It's almost like a whole nother episode, but I wonder, I don't even know which direction I'd want to even go first. I mean, because what you brought up about the acculturalization and between the generations is so important. There's a lot of stress related to that and a lot of importance for the clinician to try as much as they can to get into the worldview of the client, how much they want to hold on to the family culture versus enmesh more with the dominant culture. You want to speak a little bit to what you've seen and how you help people navigate that process?
Yeah, I think with immigrants or children of immigrants, but really like anyone foundationally, my goal is to help them feel as authentic and real to themselves as they can. So sometimes that means like dealing with the prejudice or discrimination that they're facing coming from somewhere else or having a family that comes from somewhere else or looking different or speaking differently than a predominantly white society. How are they managing the distress of that bias or discrimination or prejudice as they're dealing with it in their work or their social life and still maintaining a sense of like pride in themselves and strengths. Sometimes it is talking about like if they're wanting to adapt in a certain way, then what is it like to become more distant from those other parts of themselves? How are they maintaining a sense of authenticity and not being like overly compartmentalizing or performative in that way. I don't want to misquote any research, but in terms of my understanding, a lot of people who have a healthy sense of self are able to kind of like preserve and participate in like the multicultural parts of their identity. So they may preserve some things from their family culture or home country, but also adapt and navigate in the ways that they need to in a new context where they are, even if that requires or ends up being like a feeling of loss or grief for being in the place where they were born. So yeah, a lot comes up. I think at the end of the day, like I said, like them feeling as authentic as they can be and finding the support in terms of community and other people who understand and celebrate their culture so that they can have a sense of home to come back to. Yeah.
I love that. It's an individual process. So them finding their own, whatever that formula is for them, that feels good in their body and themselves. That's such a really beautiful barometer for how to look at this. And the supports, not doing it alone, being able to see people like them that are going through it. You mentioned the strength, the pride and the strength. And I can imagine that that's kind of like a double-sided. It seems to me that the strength and what's, you know, we often say resilience, right? That comes through managing all that can be a beautiful thing result. And also kind of like a burden where there isn't a space to be weak, to feel some of those more vulnerable feelings.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like especially the first generation born in America, like the children of immigrants, oftentimes are feeling kind of like the fear-based goals and strengths and resilience of their parents of like, we're going to come here, keep your head down, work hard. You got to be a doctor, lawyer, engineer. You got to make it happen, education, all of these things. And so like, yes, there may be that strength and resilience, but there is a lot of pressure in terms of like, I have to now be the one to fulfill all of my parents and ancestors' dreams because they made all these sacrifices and moved their whole life and did all these things. So sometimes people can, even if it's not explicitly placed on them, but like feel that pressure. And then I think it's especially hard when there are additional like family conflicts or economic issues involved. Some people feel the pressure of having to literally like be giving money back, sending money back, or providing for their family in other countries. Especially now with the current political events, people, in addition to like the drive to succeed and all of those things, the worry that people in their home countries are being harmed, that people who are here from their families and undocumented will be deported. So in terms of a trauma lens, they may have experienced trauma in the past, but then are also like dealing with a constant threat now of how the US landscape treats people from other places. And it is a hard ask to continue to maintain all of the resilience that one has to have to cope with all of that. And then do like all of the daily life tasks that everyone else also has to do, you know?
Yeah, it's a nervous system strain. And yet, you know, I imagine we have to be mindful of how much we help people to release some of that without giving them some other supports, because the challenges are very real and they do demand a certain vigilance and resilience. So we can't be naive to say, well, let that go.
Yeah. And I think it's tough because with anything, as a psychologist and therapist or anyone in any like helping profession, to know that like the help that I can give has limitations. Like there are practical things, there are like existential world event things that I and no individual can change. The limitations of my help might be helping you to be less anxious in the moments that you can access that feeling of safety and coping with the moment. and accessing maybe some resources or supports in the community. But yeah, knowing that for myself so that I'm not necessarily taking, quote unquote, taking the work home in an unhealthy way. And knowing that for them too, so that like, so that it's not an unrealistic kind of approach to seeking treatment or seeking therapy. I have some people who like, yeah, some of the other things that they have to do to maintain that resilience and connection and strength is like, they're finding community with the people from their home country, or going to a protest, or donating, or getting information out, or whatever it may be. But that there's not necessarily going to be one answer or resolution to some of these really big, traumatic, ongoing kind of things.
Do you see a role for the therapist in advocacy, or is the role more in the room and also connecting to resources?
Yeah, I mean, I think a little bit of both, like in the room with a particular person needing particular help or connection, like facilitating that to the extent that you can. I think it also is important in terms of like our just like ethical principles to reinforce that we, I don't know, like things that, I think things that seem like they would be like obvious compassion for other people are politicized a little bit. And I kind of don't see necessarily an issue with therapists on their like, whether it's their platforms or how they advertise themselves, specifically saying like, I'm an ally of these communities. I, you know, you're welcome to come to me if you're part of whatever community or supporting these things. I think even recently, like the APA, American Psychological Association, created a new division for like social justice or whatever the title might be related to that. But yeah, I think there's room for both. Like having compassion for the people that I'm working with directly and getting them help and connection. But also like if you are in this field, hopefully you have general compassion for people and their life circumstances and context and what's going on in the world. So doing the advocacy that you feel passionate for in that way too.
Beautiful. Well, this has been a really like well-rounded conversation. I learned a lot from speaking with you. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you were hoping to share today?
No, I feel like it was a great conversation. We talked about trauma and groups and immigrant populations. Those are some of my main interests and areas. Yeah, if any of your audience are in New York, I'm full down. But in the future,
get on the wait list.
If someone would want to work with a clinician in my practice, yeah, you can be on a wait list or reach out. A lot of the other clinicians in my practice are also very trauma-informed and culturally informed. Or people can look into any of my books or media. I have a book out on complex PTSD. It's like a guided journal. There's also another book that's a guided journal for Black women's mental health. And I have one being released soon on boundaries. So that's definitely an issue that comes up a lot with trauma and otherwise. Yeah, so we can look out for those things.
Tell people how to find you, your site, and any other links, and we'll put it in the show notes. Mm-hmm.
Sure. My website is growthworkpsych.org. You can also find me on Instagram at Dr. Okosi Psych, or you can find my Psychology Today just by searching my name. Some of the books that I have already available are on Amazon or other bookstores. You can find the latest book on boundaries at my website as well.
Awesome. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. I loved looking at your website. I thought your whole clinician group there is really fantastic, very strong. I was even going to reach out to you as I just took a position, but I was like, oh, I'd like to work for her. So really, really impressive. And I encourage people to seek you out. Really, you're special. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us today.
Thank you again for having me.
As we buzz around the busy world, it becomes clear there are billions of paths. As we buzz around the busy world, we will appear in other people's photographs. As we speed through the centuries, we will collide and the light will bend. We will be accidentally immortalized in someone else's land.